once again for tuning into the Psychedelic Podcast. I'm your host, Tina Marie, here with our special guest this evening, writer, director, and actor, Bill Foster. Bill, how are you doing this evening?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Of course. It's a really nice hat you have there.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Brand new. I just got it the other day. I had a new one and I ran over it with my ATV, so I had to go get another one.
Oh, no. And that's a straw hat, right?
Yes, ma'am. Summertime straw.
There you go. So I hear you have a very famous hat in the room with you as well.
I do. It's a little bit of a change here. That hat has appeared on numerous movies and a Super Bowl commercial, the H-E-B Super Bowl commercial. Cowboy Troy,
wow,
riding on the train, singing in H-E-B. I was wearing this hat. I was playing the part of a barbecue person. What happened was, I had gone to film Fear the Walking Dead. I usually clean up a lot before I drive down the road, and I really didn't have time that day, so I just put on my jeans, my boots, and this old work hat, and my work coat, and I did Fear the Walking Dead. Then I got cast for the commercial H-E-B while I was down in Austin, and it comes in a blistering cold front. So I'm standing there, you know, we're not in costume yet, and I'm sitting there shivering, have this hat on, and I see the director. She keeps looking at me, and I'm like, okay. You know, I don't know what she's looking at, you know. But finally she says, go get that man a cap because we're fixing to do another scene. I want to feature that hat later on today. And so that's what happened. They went and got me a cap. I did another scene. And then when we came back and did the barbecue scene, she had me wearing this hat. So, and then in I've Got Your Six, the military veteran who escaped from nursing home is also wearing this hat. So it's been around. These are not distress marks. These are actual sweat and hand and grease and all that.
I was going to say, are those barbecue stains on the hat?
No, that is sweat.
It's real sweat. What type of hat is that? Is that leather?
That one is I believe it's a Stetson. And this is a Twister hat here. I wear all kinds. I really like the Atwood hat. I really fell in love with those Atwood hats lately. But that hat got a little different story to it. I bought it several years ago, and I never did like the crease in it. And I would try to wear it, and I'd look in the mirror, and I was like, I just don't like it. I don't know what's wrong with it. And then one day I said, this is too good a hat to be sitting in the closet. So I take it in typical cowboy, and I dunk it in the sink, and I get it soaking wet, and I reshape it, and I get it looking almost that good.
Wow.
And then, of course, over the years, it does get a little more bent down from the hands and everything. And people, when I'm on set wearing it, they're always like, who did your hat? Where did you get that hat? Who did your hat? And I'm like, it's kind of natural, but kitchen sink did my hat, you know?
Yeah, it's like, Bill, you've got all of these really cool things that you do, especially when it comes to you being so meticulous on set when you do time period pieces. So that's a little tip right there for hats.
Yeah.
And I know that you're doing something with some shoes for the upcoming shoot that's happening for a Showdown on the Brazos, is how you pronounce
it. You got it.
I did it. Yeah. So
yeah.
I thought it was Brazos this whole time. And so do you want to show the listeners and the watchers what that shoe looks like?
Yeah.
The before after?
Here is a before. I'm working on it for a lady. Nice and shiny. And now about halfway done. And I've got sandpaper just tearing it up. Back in the day, they did not look real good. You don't want to show up shiny on an old West set. And so,
yeah,
good old sandpaper. And I had a hat soaking in the dog trough while ago, getting it wet, rebrimming it for a character. And you don't show up on an old West set with the modern day straw. I've seen some independent movies and everything's looking good. And somebody walks in with this hat like this. I'm like, oh, golly, come on.
No.
Somebody, and we do have somebody that's going to be watching just for that because you don't want the red or blue bandanas show up. You don't want modern day shirts and blue jeans. Boots are okay because we can cover them. The camera won't catch a lot of the boots and the shoes, but you'll make sure they're close. You don't want a Nike symbol or Adidas all of a sudden on camera.
So are you saying that I shouldn't wear my flip flops on set?
No, that wouldn't be good. So we've got costume for A lot of people are first in their own costumes. And so the ones that first in their own costumes, we've really got to watch and make sure their time period correct. And if you notice on this one, it does not have any of the sweat holes in the side. So all you people that want to get involved and want to buy your own hat, don't get the three sweat holes in the side because they didn't have those back then. Just get the hat without the sweat holes. And then as you wear it out, like this one, I've got numerous others, then you can start wearing it on set. And, you know, you never know where that hat may appear.
That's very true. Are you still casting for extras for Showdown on the Brazos?
Good job. No, COVID has really cut us on numbers. We're only allowed 100 people on set, and that's crew and actors. And we're at 100. I mean, we've had to turn people away. And we were really worried at first if we won't have near that many. Oh, my gosh. We've had such a resounding response to our casting call that I'm having to turn people away every day and put them on the waiting list.
That's sad. I mean, COVID has really messed up almost all of the industries. But you take a lot of precautions when it comes to filming. And that's why you're still able to have your film be worked on. Because the projected date for it was when? Did you have a date before COVID happened?
Oh, my gosh. We had finished the movie, we thought. And then when it went to the second round of edits, we decided there's some scenes that were missing. I had written some of them and I hadn't written others. So I went back and wrote some scenes to make it a better movie and just tell the story better. And we had 3 weekends planned and we got the first 2 shot. And then COVID hit the second round and shut us down. That was in July. And so finally now here we are in September. Or maybe it was June, in fact. And here we are 3 months later and we're able to film. You know, it's costing us a lot of money because we've got to have a COVID certified person on set that does nothing but watch for COVID stuff. We've got to have them a helper so that way they can either fix or come and tell us what we need to fix. We're buying hand washing stations. We've got, I don't know how many hand disinfectants we've bought to set those around. Everybody's got to wear masks when they're not filming and try to stay apart from each other unless they're family. And so we've got to do all of that, but we're going to get through. And it's a big, big shoot. I mean, Friday is a pretty good shoot, but Saturday, oh my goodness, there's going to be 100 people there. It's the new beginning of the movie. We're going to have like a 5-minute rolling shot of no cuts or anything. So that's going to take an hour or two just to set up and rehearse. And then we've got a hanging scene later in the afternoon that's going to take another 4 hours. And so big groups of people, you know, you talk about big lands and westerns. This is big groups of people intermingling with each other. And it, you know, it's the first 5 minutes of the movie. So, you know, we got to catch people and set them in that seat and make it where they can't wait to watch what happens. And so we've got a Nate Jones, the bad guy, he's flying in from Iowa. He's going to be there for us and a lot of different people and a lot of them are coming back. And what's amazing is some that didn't sign up for the movie at the very beginning, didn't think it was going to be much. Now they're like kicking themselves because they turned down some roles I offered them. And now, I wished I'd taken that role when I had the chance. That's part of it, you know, but we're really excited to get these last 3 days done.
Yes. And Jeff Davis is one of your actors in Showdown, correct?
Yes, man. He did an amazing job. First, it shocked me that, you know, we were Facebook friends, but you're Facebook friends with 5,000 people, you know, and he wanted to be in the movie. And I was like, you want to be in my movie? And so I sent him the script and he says, a beautiful script. You want to be a part of it? So we got him in. He plays the part of the preacher. He's one of the opening scenes. And man, you talk about elevating everybody's game. When he walked on set, everybody got better. I mean, all the actors just, they were like, okay, we got to be as good as Jeff.
Yes.
And so we need somebody like that every time we shoot to get everybody that good. But no, we got some really good actors. But Jeff was just amazing, the passion he brought into it. And he's so easy to work for. You know, I coach him a little bit as a director and he would change just like that. You know, he could change his persona. He would change his accent. He would change his facial expressions. Part of the scene is he writes a letter to the governor asking for help. And I said, you realize if they catch the person you just gave that letter to, they're dead. So you may have just sent that person to the deathbed. I said, I want you to look like that. And boy, he nailed it. I mean, he was able to just take the emotion straight out of his face. You just see it draining. And I turned to one of my main actresses. I said, I'm getting goosebumps, man. This guy's amazing. It captured time in a bottle. He did such a great job.
That being said, I would love for you to do something similar. Let's pretend you're in the 1880s. You've just walked into the saloon and you see your arch nemesis sitting over there playing poker. What would the first words that come out of your mouth be? Give us your best face.
Let me get in that mode here. Get ready to tell the devil I said hello.
I'm scared. I'm frightened. Yes. I cannot wait to see. Well, first of all, thank you for allowing me to be a part of Showdown in the Brazos.
You're going to be great. It's
going to take some time.
You're going to be great because we want, you know, and we want that when people cast, they don't realize, I'm sorry, on the outside looking in, they don't realize you need a, I don't want to say 3D, but you need a multi-level of extras, you know, different ages, different heights, different ethnicities, male, female. All of that comes in play when you start putting these people like a chess game around, and you need that layered look. You don't need all men standing there that's all 5'7". You know, you put the people around, you get the short ones in front, you get the tall ones in the back, you put the short ones up on the balcony or stuff like that. So it's really an art to playing extras in the right place. Then it's an art for those extras to act, because a bad extra is really bad. You know, a bad extra can ruin a movie. And if we see that, we will move them somewhere else. And, you know, one of the hardest things to do is walk normal with the camera on you.
Right.
You know, and walk across the street.
Yeah, it's not that hard.
But it is very difficult.
But people want to look right at the camera.
Yeah. And some people keep burning the camera, you're to the back. And the good thing is, on this scene, when we Saturday morning, when the outlaws hit the town, like on the count of three, they just scatter like quail, get on the balconies and everything, and guns are pointing down at the town people, and they take over the town. So, you know, as an extra, and you'll be a town person, you've got to show that emotion of being scared, because all of a sudden, here's people without being fake, you know, oh, I'm scared. You know,
wow.
Yeah.
That's my best fake bad impersonation of being scared. Oh, no.
Ah, here, call the sheriff. And you'll get in mode. We'll shoot it so many times. You'll actually forget there's cameras on you. And, you know, we'll walk or I have PAs walk around, and they may agitate you a little bit, and they may try to get you going a little bit and things like that. But you know, that's just one of the scenes. Can you imagine this guy riding into town, and all of a sudden the outlaws just take over the town and point guns down on the city, and you're all of a sudden, you know, you're looking around like, well, I can't draw a gun or I'm going to get shot, you know. And so everybody's got guns, going to hold their hands up, things like that. So hopefully that'll get people ready and interested in the movie at the very beginning.
Oh, I'm sure. That trailer is amazing. It's in the description for everybody that's watching. I really loved that. I wanted to know, because I know you're really particular about everything being time period correct. When it comes to guns, you have a lot of knowledge on those. Did you use pellet guns? Like, how did you do this?
No, it's all, there's websites you can buy reenactors guns. Now, I have been on a movie that you use plastic guns. They just gave you just plastic rubber toys. You stuck a holster and all you saw was a handle, and it's no big deal. But if you're really seeing the gun, it needs to look authentic. And I've got a whole box full of them over there that I'll carry. And some of them are just props, and some of them actually shoot blanks. And some of them used to shoot blanks, and then they got wet in a movie. Oh. Now they're just prop guns, and I got new ones. So.
Oh, I thought you were going to say they used to shoot blanks, and now they're shooting bullets again. And I was like, that's so scary.
Yeah, some reenactors do. They spend a bunch of money and buy pistols that will actually shoot bullets and shoot blanks. And so, that, you know, that's them. But I've had to buy so many, too. I just go with what I can get by with, and, you know, because I can buy two or three for what they paid for their one. And got a Civil War 1851 replica. I've never shot it, but it sure looks good on camera. And I'm going to have a lady carrying it this time, so it's going to be as big as she is nearly. You use that symbolism, you know, when she pulls this gun out and it's 10 inches long barrel, you know, it's going to make the gun look even bigger. You got a bowie knife, you know, it's got a blade this long on it. She's a pretty bad woman, I'll put it that way.
Oh, I can't wait. Is she going to be on set this September?
You bet. You bet. She will be there. The shoes I'm working on right now, those are her shoes.
Oh.
Yeah, I started to reach back and grab her pants, but they're on a different chair. We've got pants over here. I've got a living room full of wardrobe here. Your skirt's being made downtown. I've got your blouse in the living room.
I was looking at costumes and was trying to understand the time period. I don't know much about the 1880s. I just know that my father grew up watching a lot of country westerns, and I'm sure not all of them were correct with the costuming.
Nothing fit back then. It was either handmade or hand-me-down. And so Nothing really fit like it does today. You know, your pants were too big, your shirt may have been too big or a little bit too small. It's dirty or you're stained or whatever. And so like the men, a lot of times their pants were way too big in the waist. If you'll notice, that's one of the reasons why they wore them tucked in their boots, because the length didn't matter. But in modern day, when we can change that, we started wearing pants on the outside of the boots. And we'll do both on set because it's both time period, because we don't want somebody that's got good looking boot with a modern day top. We don't want the modern day top showing, so we'll cover it with the pants. I've got reenactor boots that like the Civil War top era, that's knee high, you know, like the riding boot. And I've got Civil War spurs, reenactor spurs on mine. But, you know, there's all different variations of that along the way. They all didn't wear boots. Some of them wore brogans, some of them wore shoes, you know, the introduction of shoes. And so it was a lot of different things that they wore, but nothing really fit well back then.
There were spurs back then, right?
Oh, yeah, they were.
They were highly popular, or was that something that only outlaws? And
no, they were very popular, because in today's time, a cowboy will decorate his truck, you know, hang stuff on his rearview mirror. Back then, the only thing they could accessorize was they try to get fancy spurs if they could afford them and accessorize things on their horse. You know, they'd tie different ropes on their horse or braids on their horse. And so the spurs were something very, very personalized back then. You know, the jingle bobs went through a time period where the jingle bobs made it ring when they walk. Some wore them, some didn't. Some wore the big Spanish rowels, which were big rowels on them, and some wore the more Texas. And then you've got all the way down to small, what would be the cavalry rowels. And so there's all kinds of different varieties. But that's one way. And the other way they could express themselves is a scarf that went around their neck. You know, it was just material they could find. So they were flashy. I mean, some of them were really, you know, whatever dress they could find and cut a piece out of it, or a shirt that they cut it. You know, they weren't run down to your local department store and buy a scarf and put it around your neck. It was whatever material they could find. And right. So we've got a whole bunch of them right now in a bucket in my kitchen aging. We've got Worcestershire sauce and wine soaking on the scarves.
Oh, that's amazing. That's so ingenious. Yeah. That's really interesting. Wow, Worcestershire sauce. Never would have thought it.
No, my wife figured that out, and I'm like, what's cooking? It smells good in here. She goes, I'm aging.
What a genius. Major props to every woman behind a man like Bill.
Right. My wife is everything.
They hold you all up, right?
You bet.
So about your film, I've Got Your Six, you were the writer for that.
Mm-hmm.
And it made it to the Austin Revolution Film Festival.
Quail Whistle made the Austin Revolution Film Festival. I've Got Your Six made the Wild Bunch Film Festival in Arizona. I was writer of that and director. That's the first one I did not act in. I was totally the director of. An interesting key on I've Got Your Six is ever actor in front of the camera is a military veteran. It was about a military World War II veteran, and so we decided to make everybody, if we could pull it off, everybody from the stars to the extras being veterans, and we were able to do it. And we had a preview the other night here at the house. We had five or six of the people involved with it and their spouses, and I will say the reception was amazing. That doesn't happen very often, and I can't wait for people to see that movie. And Arizona, it's nominated for Best Modern Day Short Movie.
Wow.
Best screenplay, best actor, best supporting actor, and best director. So hopefully we'll bring a trophy to your home.
That is so amazing. Congratulations. That's Thank a really you. Big achievement. Because how Thank long you. Have you been in the film industry as a non-actor, as just a writer or a director?
Just as a director, a year or so. You know, I started out in 2016 as an extra. Did that for quite a while, and I was real fortunate as an extra. They'd always picked me to be the featured extra, which means you're right there with the actors. You do everything except say their lines. And so I got to learn a lot. I got to be right beside Pierce Brosnan. I mean, the highlight of my life nearly, besides having kids and grandkids and married, you know. but I got to work with him side by side. James Parks right beside by side and get to watch that. Christoph Waltz in Alita Battle Angel. I got to work with him one-on-one. In fact, in that one, I was drunk, passed out the street. He walks by me, and it's just me and him on the camera. So, yeah, that's one-on-one. But through all this, and I can't forget to mention Ballad of Buster Scruggs with Coen Brothers. I learned so much watching the Coen Brothers. And that's a Netflix hit right there, and especially in young people, they got it memorized. And I'm amazed at how many people have seen it. You know, I've been seen by probably 10 million people, and nobody knows who I am. You know,
yeah, that's what the people that didn't get the turned down roles are going to be like, why did I turn down a role by Bill Foster?
Yeah, hopefully that's that. And then, you know, I worked a lot of independents along the way. I wrote a few scenes for somebody, and that never went anywhere. So I took those scenes and I wrote my movie around those scenes. It was just a couple of ideas. And so I wrote a whole movie around that, and that's Showdown on the Brazos. And it started out 4 or 5 actors. We were just going to get 4 or 5 actors, take an iPhone, shoot a trailer, enter it. You know, it's going to be real fun and short like that. And then now it's turned into a full video crew. We're hitting 300 actors now. And
wow.
So, and, you know, we're fixing to talk to distribution, and it's gone from 3 people in a restaurant talking about doing this to we've got our own production company. We're branching out. So it's amazing how this thing took off. You know, I've Got Your Six is a short. It's only 18 and a half minutes long, but a Showdown on the Brazos is right now 2 hours long. We're trying to trim it down. We're trimming it down and adding to it at the same time. So I don't know where it's going to end up, because after this podcast, I'm talking to my main editor right now, and we're going to figure out, okay, what can stay and what can go, you know. But he's real good at taking a scene that's 2 minutes long and condensing it down to 30 seconds, and it says the same thing, so which is really good. And then, you know, I've got a project coming up next year. I hope it takes off. I heard the quail whistle. I mentioned a while ago, it's 4 for 4 right now. I entered it so far in a lot of different contests, but I've got 4 results back, and it made the either finals or 1 in 4 of those contests. And so it's a little different. It's actually a woman is a hero in it. It's Western. My wife challenged me to write it. And so, you know, you couldn't turn down a challenge from your wife. And so I wrote the manuscript first, and the manuscript's also made the finals in Arizona, and the screenplay too. And so we'll see how that goes. But, you know, a woman is the hero. And so it's a little different. We're hoping to film it set in New Mexico. And it's going to be a SAG, where it's, you know, not necessarily independent. We get bigger actors as far as the A-listers and things like that. So can't wait. We're doing pre-production on it right now. So put it to the side for a little bit, working on Showdown when we got it cleared to do that. And then I'll pick it up as soon as we get through Showdown here in a couple of weeks and start more pre-production. Meeting with a man in New Mexico here in a couple of weeks, try to find a place. He's got a place he thinks he can get us into location to film it. You know, if we do, it's going to be awesome.
That's amazing. What do you attribute your very early success to? I mean, not many people get into the entertainment industry with just 4 years of experience and start directing films or writing films that make it into film festivals. That's such a huge achievement.
I pinch myself every day. I'm very lucky, but I will say I'm very creative. Most of my films, I try to make them touch relationships or big part of it. Not love stories necessarily, but a relationship. And you fall in love with the main characters. I wrote them, Showdown on Brazos, like a old Jimmy Stewart, John Wayne type genre movie, where you fall in love with the main character that you got to go, and you hate the bad guy. And so I heard the quail whistle. You're going to fall in love with her, the main character, because she's going to go through a lot of ups and downs. We talked about the wives a while ago. You know, back in the 1800s, women couldn't vote. They didn't have a whole lot of say, but they were so strong in holding that family together. And what people don't realize today is while the husband is out plowing or you know, the horse and team or whatever he was doing with, you know, in the fields, she was taking care of the kids, feeding the hogs, milking the cows, gathering the eggs. And when she got through with all that, making meals, she would go out and still help the husband. And she would just get to quit early and come home and do all the chores with the kids. And I don't know how they stayed awake during the day, because you'd think they just pass out after a while.
With no AC, no TV, no nothing. And so look at us, humanity. Look how spoiled we are. Think about the 1800s. Think about the wars that were happening then. And think about your masks.
Yeah. And so I tried to incorporate all of those feelings into her in this story, because she goes from the top of the world to the bottom of the world back to the top of the world. So it's really an emotional roller coaster.
Oh wow. So you plan on doing a lot more films in the future, and they're not all gonna be Westerns. What were those ideas you had?
I've got one, it's called Wind is Home. In fact, we performed it in the Brownwood Local Theater, and it was written as a playwright performance. And it was performed 9 times and had 9 standing ovations. It's set in the 60s during the Vietnam War. And so I want to take that and go back and make a movie of it. I really want to delve in onto the Vietnam side. But my main focus on that play was the boyfriend and girlfriend, they fall in love at the very beginning, get married, and he gets drafted and sent to Vietnam. And I split the stage at that point. And so half the stage is the house back where she was living. He gets captured and is put in a POW camp. And so the other half of the stage is a POW cell. So it's showing the difficulties, not only for the soldier in POW camp, because he really has to just worry about himself. He's got to worry about living. You know, now he's having to worry about struggling to stay alive every day, but he's worried about himself just getting there. Back home, the wife is worried about him, her, the family, people coming by giving their advice, you know, that you don't necessarily want. And it's called Windows Home because during the movie, when he gets sent to Vietnam, she has her dad bring in her bed and put it in the kitchen so she can look out the west window of the house. And so she can say, I'm looking west and I will see you out there someday. Even though you're 20,000 miles away in Vietnam, I can talk to you out my window and it'll be like you're there. Well, he gets captured, and lo and behold, his window is an east window. And so on stage, they're actually looking at each other on stage, but they're 20,000 miles in between talking to each other, you know, like, talking about how much they miss each other, you know, what's going on at home, who's been coming by to see them. He's talking about what's going on in the POW camp. You know, they can't hear each other, but yet it's, you know, black, you know, one lights up and then the other lights up. And so
that's great.
Thank you. I want to take that and really delve into it and make it more of a movie and go into the Vietnam side of it where we can film him being captured. And I think the home side will stay about the same, but I think we can expand that other because it's already an hour and a half long like it is. So, you know, we don't need to delve too much into it changes. But and then, you know, I've got an outline on that can be based really anywhere from the 20s to the 50s about a forbidden love set in Louisiana, and you know, the sharecropper's son falls in love with the plantation owner's rich daughter, and they're not supposed to love each other, and you know, get all that kind of stuff. And big ranch owner tries to have the kid killed, and you know, there's all kinds of things. But I love the swamp, I love the sound of the swamp, I love the time period. Imagine an old 1940s pickup flying down to this dirt road on the swamps on both sides. That's the kind of things I visualize. Another one I've got, it's a modern day based in Mexico. I can't wait to possibly shoot that. I think that'll become a cult film because there's a certain college, if we can use their fight song, I can't say who, if we can use their fight song, we will have thousands of fans.
Definitely. And I will be auditioning for those roles.
Yeah, there you go.
So you're drinking on a glass of wine. Tell us a little bit about you when you're not on set.
I'm a retired educator and really didn't plan on doing the movie business. It just kind of fell in my lap and just by accident. After I retired, I was in elk hunting in Colorado. And one of the hunters talked about his brother has a winery and they were short grapes, couldn't find enough grapes. And I said, I'm looking for something in a small crop that I can make some money. Well, where we lived didn't have the right water. So we ended up selling that place, buy another place. And we've got a vineyard now, 7 acres. 1 acre we just harvested and they're staggered and they're all going to be red wine. We're going to make about 100 bottles this year. It's in the winery right now being fermented. And then next year we should make probably 500 or 600 bottles or more. You know, it's just going to grow every year. And so we got some well needed rain today. And so I was out there earlier today and it's nice and muddy. And so everything's good right now when it rains.
Yes, it was a really long thunderstorm last night since we're both in Texas for everybody that's watching. Yeah, I was there for the rain.
And the name of our vineyard is Quail Whistle Vineyard. We did take that after I heard the Quail Whistle story because when it won some awards, we decided we liked the name. So we made our vineyard the Quail Whistle Vineyard and we made our production company Quail Whistle Productions. We just kind of kept that title. And then, like I said, our next major movie is I Heard the Quail Whistle. And there's a story on how I got that title also for the manuscript. You know, a lot of times titles come right to you when you're writing. I could not get a name for this book. I couldn't, or manuscript. And I was fixing to enter it, so I had to have something. And I'm outside. It's the middle of June, 3 days away from the deadline entering it, and I'm feeding my horses, and I can't think of a name. I'm just brainstorming, and I hear a quail whistle off in the distance. And I said,
a sign.
There is the name of my book. I heard the quail whistle. And so I ran in the house, got on my computer, tied some quail into the story so it would make sense. So that's how we became, I heard the quail whistle, and from that, Quail Whistle Productions and Quail Whistle Vineyard.
Oh, I can't wait to see that so that I can try to listen for the quail and see what that means in that film. No spoilers.
That's right. We try to put a quail whistle in all of our major movies. It's not in I've Got Your Six, but it's in a Showdown. So there's always going to be a quail whistle in them.
So on your IMDb page, I noticed Showdown on the, and I am probably going to botch this. It could either be Guadalupe, Guadalupe.
Guadalupe.
Yes. Okay. That's what I thought, but I didn't know how Texans pronounced it. So Guadalupe. So Showdown on the Guadalupe and your upcoming film Showdown on the Brazos. So what's the difference? Is there a correlation between those two films?
Not at all. They're totally different. In fact, Showdown on the Brazos wasn't even supposed to be named that. I just stuck that on there to have a title. I sent it in not thinking it was going to win anything, you know, hoping it would win, but I never thought of it. And then when it started winning awards, then I couldn't change the title. I was going to change it later on as I refined it. And my wife said, you're going to have a Showdown on Never River in Texas, I guess. So, Showdown in Guadalupe is my first novel that I hadn't released. I've written a lot. I just have not put them out there yet. And that one, again, is a reluctant hero. And he goes chasing a bad Indian all over Texas. And the good thing about this, yeah, I know it's geographically or regionally situated, but what book is it? If you're from Texas and you buy that book and you read that book, you're going to say, as you read it, this is where this scene took place. I know this place. And I've had lots of people come to me. They really don't know exactly where it was. They say, I think I know where you wrote that. I think I know what place you're talking about. And you know, I try to mention, you know, landmarks like Enchanted Rock, San Saba Peak, things like that. The San Saba River, Llano River, the red granite of Llano County and you know, Guadalupe eventually. And so I had a friend, he called me one night. He said, I'm mad at you. And I said, what did I do? He said, I got to get up at 4 a.m. I started reading a stupid book and I can't stop. You know,
that's a good problem to have, right?
Yeah, that's a good problem to have. So I hear that more often than anything is once I get into it. Of course, you got to go through that chapter two of character building, which I'm not good at. I have to work at it. But people, once they get started and get involved in it, and there is a love story, there's always got to be a love story involved. And basically what it is a man comes out of the Civil War, goes to Texas to escape because the carpetbaggers took his land away in Virginia. And so he just goes to Texas on a whim. He's the only educated person in town, so they make him a school teacher. Everything's good. He's teaching school, fixing to get married, and all of a sudden Saberhead, which is a renegade Indian, starts raiding around. Historically, at that point after Civil War, there was no law in Texas. The Texas Rangers were gone, either fighting the Indians and all over Texas, or everybody had gone to fight Civil War. And the cavalry had all left because we'd run them out during Civil War. So there was actually no law enforcement in Texas. And oh, wow. So they elect Elijah Bishop to go after Saberhead. And so he gets two or three cowboys, and they start on this march to try to get Saberhead. And they go all over Texas. And as the book says, sometimes the hunter becomes the hunted. All over Texas, you know, he's chasing them, they're chasing him, type deal. And I tried to make Saberhead as mean as possible, as ugly as possible. And, you know, when people hear the word Saberhead, panic automatically goes in there, kind of like, you know, in the old days, Geronimo. You know, Geronimo's here. Oh, my gosh, he's going to kill us all. Same thing with Saberhead. He's got a different name. I can't remember it now. But the reason they call him Saberhead is because he got hit in the head with saber by a cavalry soldier when he's a little boy. And so it peeled half his face off. And so he's got this big old skin of his face hanging down on this side. And so he's kind of sadistical now. He's a little off at the cavalry and the white people. He just wants to kill them.
I wanted to ask, when I was doing a little bit of research on your upcoming film, I looked into it and I saw that the Texas Rangers actually were begun by the Spaniards. Is that true?
By Stephen F. Austin. And Stephen F. Austin got a group of men together because there was no law enforcement. He called them the Rangers. And because that way they could take care of the mainly the renegade Indians that were raiding the neighborhood, the villages and everything. So they got this band together, and they actually disbanded during the Civil War, but then they got back together. And that's now an organization run by the Highway Patrol. But yeah, Stephen F. Austin actually started the Texas Rangers way back in the 1830s. And he is the father of Texas, and he got a lot of land grants. And, you know, that's part of the big fight for independence back in 1836, Davy Crockett, because they arrested Stephen Austin when he got there, because when Santa Anna took over, he reneged on all the land grants. And so there Stephen F. Austin was in Mexico, in Monterey, and trying to do all the work. And all of a sudden he gets arrested. He finally gets out, but he's very sickly and all that from what being staying. I think he's got tuberculosis or something from being in jail. But that's part of what Texas was actually fighting over. And a lot of, we can call them Tejanos, they fought against the Mexican because it was a dictatorship. And Texas wanted its independence because they were changing the laws on Texas, not Mexico, but, you know, Santa Ana was saying, if you're in Texas, you got to follow these rules. And so right. They didn't mock them, and the independence stood up. And if you fought for the Texas independence, you got 640 acres. Didn't wow. Know where it was going to be. Davy Crockett came to get some of that 640 acres. He just didn't know the fighting was still going strong. You know, yeah. He signed on to Nacogdoches to get his 640 acres. And he really thought the fighting was about over. And so he goes down to San Antonio to help. And he didn't really know how much fighting there was left. And so we just got real lucky. You know, if Santa Ana had just passed the Alamo and gone off Sam Houston, Texas wouldn't be where it is today.
It definitely wouldn't. Okay, you've been on a lot of shows. You mentioned Fear the Walking Dead. Did you play a zombie in that?
I did. First, I played.
How was that?
That was awesome. First, I played the Vulture. And a Vulture was a gypsy-type character that was going to try to overthrow the main characters. And, you know, trying to overthrow the main characters turns out well. And so they killed me and then brought me back as a zombie. And then they send you to zombie school, which mine was only like 15 minutes. But some had to be remediated on how to walk like a zombie. you learn how to walk like a zombie. I wore a mask, a latex mask, because, and there's different levels of zombies or walkers. And it's really neat to watch that on how they level everybody. And, you know, people are blurry in the background for a reason. They just look like there's more of them. The last time I worked on the set, we were down in Gonzales, 95 degrees, 90% humidity, miserable. We're in Johnson grass up to our shoulders. It's funny because some of us are sitting under a tree at break just dying. And I'm one of them dying. I'm just like, I don't have much more. It's like, you know, pouring water over our heads. And then there's another group
of zombie makeup just falling off your face.
Yeah. And then there's another group over and laughing, talking. I'm like, they're not working as hard as I am or something. But, you know, you carry the mask on your hand. So you don't get down or get flat. So you carry it on your hand. Sweat's dripping off your elbow because it's just like a plastic bag. And so you put this plastic bag over your face. You got two eye holes about that big and a nose hole about that big to breathe through. Skin tight. And so you're walking and tripping. And
yeah. And here we are again complaining about wearing masks when we go into certain stores when you have to be a zombie for 12 hours a day on set with that heavy latex plastic on your face.
Yeah, you can't wait. They say, okay, you demask, and there's a certain way, and you put your hand under the mask like this, and they come over and pull them off of you because they're very expensive, and they don't want people just ripping them off. You got to wait for somebody to help you get them off, and so they peel them off, and you're like, oh, get that off, you know. But it's such a relief when you do get that mask off, and then you still wear makeup underneath the mask so that way they can't see your eyes or anything like that. So it was a lot of fun, very good experience. In fact, I was leaving the set of Fear the Walking Dead, fixing to start Showdown on Brazos. We've got 10 crew members or so, and I'm walking past all those 18-wheelers and all the cameras and sound gear and cords and everything else at Fear the Walking Dead. I'm like, am I going to be able to do this or not?
Major production,
yes. Yeah, but we're proving that with technology today that you can compete with, you maybe not be able to compete with the biggest boys, but you can sure give it a run.
Yes, absolutely. And I wanted to move on to this next question I have for you, because you had mentioned Pierce Brosnan. Everybody knows who that is and your experience with him. Have you had any other celebrity encounters, and what was it like meeting Pierce Brosnan?
He was super nice. We got through with the scene and he actually shook my hand and said, good job, chap. Me and another guy, we played the Outlaws, and we're leaned up against waiting, you know, just it's a break. And so we're leaned up against the horse rail just like this. And Pierce walks in, and he's not in costume or anything. He comes over and just starts talking to us like every day, you know. He's a blast just to be around somebody. You know, I scared death when it started, and somebody told me, hey, they're human too. And that's when you realize they are human. James yeah. Parks is really neat. He's working on his lines 9 out of 10 minutes. They shoot a minute, he goes back over the corner. He's working on his lines. Pierce seems like it comes a little easier to him. You wonder when they have time to memorize all these lines because, you know, they're there 12 hours a day, and it's amazing. But got to work with Christoph Waltz, got to work with Evan Evans. I don't know if you know him. His dad's Bill Evans. He's my composer. Bill Evans was his dad, who was, I believe, 18-time Grammy Award-winning jazz pianist. And, wow. And so Evans, my composer. And then, of course, the Coen brothers. And I got to actually talk to Ethan. He came over and talked to me about if I could do something on set. You know, he wanted me to, as I turned, to follow the bartender, the piano player. I was like, yes, sir, you name it, and I'll do it. You know, just watching them, you know, if it'd been me and my brother, we'd had 3 fistfights in one day trying to make a movie. And him, Joe and Ethan are so, they work so good. You know, one of them sets up the set, the scene, and they shoot it. Then the other one walk over and change it, and they shoot it. And then the other one walks over and change it again, and they shoot it. And I'm just like, how do these guys keep from getting in a fight, you know? Because if I set it up and then my brother would come in and change it, I'd be grabbing him by the hair of the head. You know, we'd be going after it.
Words might be happening behind the scenes.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, we were in the saloon. It was our holding room. And we're there one morning. And I told the guy, one of the other extras, I said, come here. And looking out the saloon doors, you know, you got the nice, frilly saloon doors. On the other side, I'm perfectly framed, was both Coen brothers working on the script. And if I'd had a camera, I could have taken a picture and they'd been framed in that saloon door. I told the guy, I said, where else but in America, a couple old guys like you and me get to work with somebody, Academy Award winning, Golden Globe winning directors like they are. And so if I can ever hold a light to them, it'll be amazing. And so, you know, I love Steven Spielberg, John Ford, all those. But, you know, the thing about director, most people can't name the really, like name their favorite movie, they can name their favorite actor. But then you say, who directed it? And they're like,
it's so important. I mean, if you really love a film, you know every single part of it. You watch all of the credits roll by. You make sure you know who's in that and what all the lines of the movies. Real film lovers know this. They will say the line before it happens when they've rewatched a film.
Mm-hmm. You know all the lines before the actors say them. And so when they say them, I don't make them say, it's not Shakespeare. I told him, I said, whatever comes natural. If you need to change it a little bit, change it. But yeah, you know exactly what, and if they keep missing the line, you go, whoa, whoa, whoa. But I try to use Clint Eastwood's method of not overshooting, because I read where, you know, he shoots it 3 or 4 times. Change the angles. In one scene, you're going to shoot it 15, 20, 30 times. I've been on one set, they would shoot it 15 times from that one angle, just getting the right one. I don't do that. I shoot it 3 or 4 times. I want the actors to be fresh. I don't want to sit there and go be like a robot. Yeah. And so I feel like after 4 or 5 times, they start getting rusty. And so we move on. Change the angle of it.
Especially with a big, big team or a lot of extras, you can't afford to be shooting just that scene 15 times with a few extras. It's important, but it's not going to be detrimental if it hits the cutting room floor, right? Yeah, so if they're burned out, they're burned out.
Yeah, and extras, always do what the director tells you to, because the only time I've got, or as our crew got frustrated, is when you tell the extra, stand here, you leave and you come back and they're gone. And because they're talking to a friend or whatever, and you're like, we're trying to set up everybody. Every time you do that, you lose 5 minutes. And throughout the day, you could lose an hour. And you know, if a set's costing you $1,000 a day, how much did that hour cost the set? Or if that, you know, then you start in the action and the crew and all that that's getting paid. And remember too, that you're not the star. You are a very big part of the movie, but you're not the star. You can't address the star. You can't run around and get a selfie with them and all that kind of stuff. But you are as integral as the main star, because watch a movie and pretend there's no extras is boring as it can be. And so, we're going to have some really good extras that make this town look like it's alive and bustling. Otherwise, it'd just be really boring, you know, just a couple of actors talking. You watch it in life, you see these people just talking, you're like, what was that? And then you see it on camera, you're like, oh my goodness, you know, wow, that's a movie.
Yes. And that's what's so exciting is because you're so meticulous with the design of the set and the outfits and everything being completely time period appropriate. That is one of the things that I am most excited to see. I feel like I'm going to walk on the set when I come there this September. It is September now. And yeah. In the next couple of weeks, and it's going to be like really walking into the old Wild West. And that is so fun for me because time period pieces are amazing, especially when they're done properly, which I think that's got to have contributed to a lot of your early success already. Yeah. Is the fact that you are so meticulous.
Yeah. And I had that same feeling on The Sun. One time we were at a set and they wouldn't let us walk on the set. So we get our costumes on, you know, it's Wild West, 1915, turn of the century. And so we're sitting there and holding. They said, okay, we're the Law and Order, let's go. And I walk out the back door of our set and you walk into it's 1915. And I just stood there. I was shocked. You know, there's horses, there's Model Ts, there's smoke, and there's already some extras out there and they're in costume. And I'm just standing there looking. I'm like, oh my gosh. It's 1915. And then all of a sudden, PA, you know, come on, get over here. You know, and you wake up like, oh, okay. You take off running.
Oh, where's the coffee? So yeah. I have a couple last questions for you. Okay. So when it comes to this one, Showdown on the Brazos, then yeah. Were you always very interested in this time period? Is that where the inspiration comes from? So you had yes. The knowledge already, and then you just put that to work in what you wrote.
I was raised on a farm. Watched every John Wayne movie that ever came across our three networks. You know, we only had three channels. And so I watched every Western that ever came across. And then when VHS and DVDs came out, first thing I would watch was behind the scenes, deleted scenes and things like that. They were, to me, more interesting than the actual movie. So, you know, I love that part of it and see how they transformed towns or built towns just for that scene or in the costumes and things like that. So, this is going to be a lot of fun on I Heard the Quail Whistle when we do have a costume department rather than my living room. You know, it's covered up right now. And my wife's in there. She's ironing and sewing and doing all the things. You know,
being a homesteading pioneer wife.
That's right. I'll be able to tell the costume department, I want this coloration. A good example of coloration is True Grit and the very first part of Ballad of Buster Scruggs. They're in that same color form. Everything is grays or dark browns or blacks. There's no wild colors or anything, and it really sets the scene. So you try to set the scene with people, you know, with your color coordinator or costumer, say, okay, this is what we want. And then you go from there. So just the color of the costume can set the mood for the scene. So take a look at those two by the Coen brothers and notice the costumes, and now you'll be able to pick it out.
Amazing. And then the screenplay that you have written based on the 1960s, what was the inspiration behind that with the Vietnam War and the love story and the POW?
They were older than me, so they were my heroes growing up. When I was in junior high, elementary, they graduated in high school, so they're the guys I looked up to. And I still remember watching my mother made us come in from playing and watch the POWs coming home. When they'd fly into the airport, come home, the families would greet them on the airport, and that really stuck in my mind. And so I've always been intrigued with the Vietnam War, the things we did right, the things we did wrong. And right. So I did a lot of research. You know, you can't do research watching movies. You got to watch like PBS specials on the historical side of the Vietnam War. I read a lot of articles, read a lot of interviews with these soldiers. I've even interviewed some of the soldiers. I went to college with some of the soldiers that had just come back. I graduated in 1980. Some of them had just got back in 72 and then came to college. They went to business for a while and came back to college on the GI Bill. And so they were right there beside me in college. So they could tell me firsthand what was really going on. A simple story is one soldier told me they were starving to death out there in the jungles. And, you know, the airplanes would drop their sea ration stuff in. So here came the big planes. Here come the umbrella, the boxes. And they're running out there under fire, can't wait to get the food, open it up, and it's beer. It's beer.
Oh, wow. That's
and they didn't have pull tabs back then. And it was so rusty, they'd take their fingers and just poke a hole in the top to drink it. I'm not going to say the brand, but it was not an expensive brand. And they didn't even have to open it. They just stick their finger in the hole and knock the top out and drink. They were still hungry, but they were drunk too. You know.
They were happy. I mean, if you didn't eat and you drank some beer, then you're good.
Yeah,
it's enough calories to get you by.
There you go. You know, in the bars in Saigon and all of where the military could go, could not buy more beer until they ran out. You know, Americans kept them furnished in beer for the soldiers, and they couldn't reorder till they run out. So they would have penny beer night. So he said, I could go to town, get drunk, and tip the waiter on a quarter. Because it was penny beer night, and I could drink 10 or 15 beers and with a 25-cent quarter and throw it on the table and walk out, you know. Then they get rid of all their beer, and they could get more fresh beer in. So you didn't know what brand you were going to have. It's just whatever they had on stock. But, you know, penny of beer, who cares?
Yeah, so there was definitely, like we have today, there was no tip your server 100% trends going on back then. Well, Bill, if you want to close up with anything that you'd like to tell the audience or any kind of words of inspiration for people wanting to write films or direct films or be an extra in any of your upcoming films, this would be a great time to say all of that so I could throw it up on the banner for you.
You bet. The only thing holding you back is yourself. If you want to write a script, you can do that with computer software. You can enter it in contests. But if you're an aspiring director, write a script. Everybody's got a phone with a camera on it and sound. Go in your backyard, get your friends, and then make that little movie. It doesn't have to be big. It just, you find out if you like it. And then all of a sudden you're like, man, I love this. I think I'll get a better camera, or I'll get somebody with a better camera coming here. I'll write a better part. And it grows from that. Or you may say, I don't like it. I don't like that. I'll do something different. But if you want to be the actor side of it, you got to apply for everything, whether you get paid or not, because I read that article and that's what I did. I got real lucky on some sets. I've been on a lot of those sets where I didn't even get lunch. We got maybe a bag of chips and a drink. I've been pizza. One where they said, okay, lunch break, and you went and found your own lunch, and you the total cost was yours. But you do that and get your resume built up, and then you don't have to do those. Then you can do the ones that pay, and you got to be able to travel some. Being an extra, sometimes if it pays, maybe I pay $70, it may take you $50 with gas. But you learn, and you learn, and you create your skill. And sooner or later, if you want to get those lines, you just keep on hammering. Keep on hammering, because there's going to be somebody in that crowd like me that's going to decide to branch out and be a director. And they remember Tina Marie that worked with me really well on Fear the Walking Dead or one of those independents. And I really liked her look, and she did a good job, has a great attitude. I'm going to give her some lines and see how she does. She has some lines. Oh, she does great. Guess what? It's going to be on the next movie. Tina Marie's going to have more lines, you know. And so you never know. And you never know. Keep those ties. And you find out the goods and the bads. And don't associate yourself with the bads. Just associate yourself with the goods.
Yeah. Sometimes when people on set, other extras tell you, don't talk to this person, there's a reason why. Not everybody's out to get you. So don't use that as a reason to go and talk to that person, because that person could just bring you all the way down to where you don't want to be.
And don't get jealous. And you don't know everything as an extra. You don't know everything's going on. That's the first thing I learned is I got cut from a scene. I thought I'd done something wrong. And turned out they just needed 5 people instead of 10. And, you know, I worried all weekend. I'm like, what did I do wrong? And come find out, we just need 5 people instead of 10. Okay, now I understand. And, you're not there every day, and a lot of people wear their feels on the sleeve, and they're tired, and you may get yelled at, but you just keep on moving on, and you find out the ones you do and don't want to work for. But I've never raised my voice on set, and nobody in my crew has either. But sometimes that happens because they've been working 14-hour days. Extras may be working 12. Crews 14, 15, 16-hour days.
Oh, yeah.
And it's been going on day after day after day like that, so.
The poor lights and camera guys and the audio people, they're so important. They're working 20 hours a day sometimes.
Exactly.
You got to think about those.
On short sleep. And so we all have those short moments. But it's a grueling process, but it's a lot of fun. It's just magic. And I enjoy every bit of it. I enjoy the costuming. You know, now that I'm director, I enjoy all of it, creating that big picture. You know, as an actor, you create a little bitty part of the big picture. As a director, you create the big picture. And so you paint the whole thing.
Yeah, and I have a tip for actors that don't just want to be extras. When you're working with somebody like Bill, you have to realize, like he just said, you might, if you make a good connection with him, he might help you out. And I know you have an email. It's quailwhistle@gmail.com, right, for future casting calls. I'm going to pop that up there for you.
You bet. And the messenger on Facebook, and Facebook, we do a lot of casting calls on Facebook. It's where our major one is. Texas Actors for Westerns is another group that we post a lot on. We try to get it out as much as we can, and really appreciate all the response we had on the last casting call. It was so much bigger than what we ever thought it would be. And, you know, like I said, we're hitting 300 now actors. Who would have ever thought back when we had 4 actors signed up that we'd hit 300? So who would have thought?
That's amazing.
Me and my wife and the cameraman meeting on the restaurant that night, we'd be where we are now. So we're branching out, go from the movies I'm working on. We're going to also have a division of other movies, TV commercials, TV shows. It's just, it's really taking off right now.
Big congratulations to that and all of the success you've already had. And Phil Foster, thank you so much. You were a gentleman. And I'm very honored to have spoken with you. And I'm really excited to see what your set looks like next week with my family. This is going to be so much fun. And I'm sure everybody's going to really enjoy the film. The trailer, everybody's in the description. Check it out. It's Showdown on the Brazos, not Brazos.
You got it. On YouTube.
All right. Yes, it's on YouTube. It's in the description of this. So go and check it out.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Foster. You have a good evening.
You too. Take care.